Hello, Trek everybody, Trek fans, Trek everything you want to be. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and wherever you are in the galaxy. This is Story Trek. My name is Marshall Hopkins.
And I'm Michael Stridigakis.
We always try to give you a little bit of the good, the bad, and the ugly. The last episode was a lot of ugly and bad. This time we're going to give you some good. Of course, this is the podcast where we talk about stories in Star Trek, and this time we're going to dissect canon. But we would be remiss if we didn't take a few moments to talk about all the amazing developments that happened this week during Star Trek First Contact Day.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this was quite an event this year. I mean, between the panel discussions and the teasers for season two of Picard and the first images for Star Trek Prodigy, I mean, then the new Star Trek mission in Chicago. I mean,
right.
How awesome is that now that they're actually going to have the convention in a different city every single year as opposed to Vegas?
It opens the door to a lot more people getting to go to a convention. I think privately I called it Trekapalooza.
Yeah, you did. You did. And I think that's really good for Star Trek as a whole because, you know, Star Trek, people come to it from a different points in their lives and at different generations over 50-something years. And in the course of that, not everyone fits into that same mold of someone who would necessarily go to Vegas, even for a Star Trek convention. And of course, there's also the perceptions of what is a Star Trek fan. And I think that it's going to be really interesting to see how the demographics change of Star Trek conventions as a whole, at least as far as the official cons are concerned.
It's really an exciting time to be a Star Trek fan. I feel like as a fan, you've recognized that this is sort of a mega franchise, really. There's multiple series with hundreds, maybe thousands of hours of programming. And yet you watch other franchises, you know, maybe the Star Wars franchise or the Marvel franchise and those sort of things. And you see how they branch out and expand in some fascinating ways and in ways you didn't think could fit within their genre. And so it's really exciting to finally see Star Trek doing that sort of branching out with the many different things we saw that are going to be available this year on Paramount Plus.
Yeah. And not only all that coming through the wire, but we just got word, I think just before we recorded this the other day, that Paramount has announced a release date for a new Star Trek film, June 9th, 2023. Now, it's a ways off, but you know what? I mean, I'm kind of surprised they're doing this.
It's kind of surprising. I've heard nothing about, you know, casting announcements. This person has been re-signed, or this is the writer, or this is the director. So either they've been doing all of this in secret, or it's sort of a moonshot to a certain extent. I don't know, but I'm excited to see what's going to be produced.
Last I saw, there was, let's see, I mean, they've gone through so many writers and so many ideas for the fourth JJ film, produced film. By the way, Bad Robot will be producing this movie. I mean, we had J.D. Payne and his Captain Kirk meets his dad business. We've had the rumor of Tarantino and piece of the action type of gangster Pulp Fiction Trek. We've had Noah Hawley and apparently some sort of pandemic story, which obviously did not test too well. And last we had this one by Kalinda, I believe her name is Kalinda Vasquez. Kalinda, actually named after a character from Star Trek by any other name, if you remember the Kelvin by the name of Kalinda. How appropriate that she is a Kelvin and perhaps writing for the Kelvin timeline. But anyway, I digress. The point is, this would be really interesting to see someone who comes from sort of a steeped background of her own life as a Star Trek fan, at least growing up, and now coming full circle to be writing a Star Trek film, if this does indeed pan out.
Yeah, it's fascinating how, you know, you actually have the opportunity to have people who are lifelong fans of Star Trek, who are steeped in it, who now get to work on it and create it. Again, very exciting time. I'm not sure if that's something that you could have had in maybe 1987. You could have, you know, possibly by the 1990s. You know, you obviously had people who were fans of the show working even then, but now you have this, Star Trek is such a fandom where you can have multiple generations of fans in one family.
Exactly.
I'm an example of that myself. So this is going to be really fascinating to see. I think we will, for the first time with the conventions and with the new Star Trek media, get to see the full scope of just how big Star Trek actually is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, and I'm speaking just for myself here. I feel that in many ways over the last, at least the last 10 or 12 years, as well-meaning as some of the things have been that CBS has done with Star Trek, and I understand the schism with Paramount was a factor in some of this, but it never felt like Star Trek was given, I mean, they were putting hundreds of millions of dollars into the movies. They've obviously put lots of money into these new shows. But then when it came to actually putting Star Trek and framing it for new audiences, I've been kind of surprised at the way that the lack of effort, in my opinion. I mean, because the way I look at it is you're about to invest all this money into like a cinematic universe of Star Trek. And the only place you can see it is Paramount Plus. And in fact, it was sort of the guinea pig for Paramount Plus when it was CBS All Access.
Right.
And I was kind of surprised they didn't try to like tease it a little bit more on CBS broadcast in order to then bring people over to the CBS digital world. I think that was a big mistake because I think a lot of fans and a lot of non-fans were not able to attach and latch on to Star Trek as easily as they would, say, a show on Netflix because of CBS All Access not being exactly a go-to platform for people at this point.
Right.
And I think that the Paramount thing, haha, pun intended, is that Star Trek finds a way to make itself accessible to new fans that is not intimidating. And when I say this, I say this from someone who many, many times over many years, when somebody would approach me and ask me, Star Trek is however many years old, where do I start watching it? You know, do I have to start in the 1960s to understand it? Can I just watch the new JJ movies? And it's not so cut and dry because you could start in the 60s and then you're like, wow, this is pretty far back. It's really dated. There's some really interesting problematic stuff in here. There's some obviously bad effects. You know, the show's very limited by the budget. Some people, especially younger audiences, are a little turned off by some of that stuff. Now, then there's people who jump into the Star Trek of the 80s and the 90s. And sure, you could start with Star Trek The Next Generation. But then even then, it's like, wow, you have all of this in what's become known as canon from the original series show and then the movies. And there's sort of the weight of that, especially for the first two seasons of The Next Generation. And when you say, okay, well, let me just jump ahead to the JJ movies, you're like, okay, well, these are new actors, they're telling the story from the beginning, but hold on a second, who's this Ambassador Spock guy, and why does this Nero care, and who's the Romulans, and what's right. going on with their planet? And while the entire Kirk and Spock storyline are completely fresh and new, the whole antagonist of the film comes from a different part of the Star Trek universe and actually brings along with it a different Spock, actually, in Leonard Nimoy. So you're constantly, as a new fan, introduced to things as that sort of the old Star Trek universe, and it's not so cut and dry. I mean, for instance, you could go watch Incredible Hulk, or you could go watch Thor. And you don't need to have to see the first Iron Man movie to see the first Thor and understand it and follow it for the 90% of the 95% of the movie. There's details of this and that, you can pick it up. But we're talking about time travel, at least in the Kelvin timeline business. And right. Then you know, who's this Nero guy? He's an alien or he's got tattoos on his face. What's up with that? Like, there's just a lot of little things that just from the get-go, it challenges new viewers. And that's the thing about canon as a whole, and that's what we're talking about today, is that canon is not only just challenging for the viewers, but it's also a challenge for the writers. So today I thought, you know, and Marshall and I were talking about this, that we would discuss a little bit about it from the perspective of the writer.
So let's dig in. Probably the first place to start would be the transition between the original series and the Next Generation. That's fertile ground because I feel like, number one, it's a combination of you're locked into canon as a writer, but also you're sort of free. There hasn't been as much that's been developed as we now know. Of course, there was still room for Ronald Moore to give us so many great stories about the Klingons. There was still room to, you know, introduce new alien species and things like that. Yet at the same time, you almost feel like TNG struggled to get out of a different sort of canon. And it's the interpersonal canon of the TOS crew.
That's very true. In fact, there was the whole idea of the Next Generation series just trying to get out from underneath the shadow of the original series. And in fact, even second season, by bringing in a different doctor, Dr. Pulaski, she created this antagonistic relationship with Data that sort of paralleled the Bones and Spock combination of the original series. And it didn't land the same way that it did before for various reasons. I mean, there's just lots of experiments that were successful and not successful. In fact, they recycled episodes from the original series and new titles, Naked Now, Naked Time. And then they had The Child, the season 2 premiere episode, which is actually, as I recall, a Star Trek Phase 2 discarded script. So I guess that would have been Ilea who would have been impregnated. I if anybody out there has read some of the Phase 2 storyline summaries or scripts, or happen to have a hold of one of the scripts, I'd love to know if it was Ilea or was it Nurse Chapel or Uhura. I don't know. I think it was Ilea. But the point is, when you're looking at Star Trek and canon as a writer, it becomes a very daunting thing because as a writer, you feel like, okay, well, this is the best choice I can make for my character and have them do this X, Y, Z thing, and this is their character. And then, you know, if you've got somebody in the room who's steeped in the history of Trek, depending on what era that you're working out of, they could say, well, according to this and this, you can't have them meet because, you know, the Romulans didn't meet until Kirk met the commander of the Romulan warbird in Balance of Terror. You know, so suddenly in Enterprise, you can't have a Romulan meeting a Starfleet officer. Okay. So everywhere you turn, it's like, well, there's a rule there. Oh, we can't have that. Oh, we can't have this drama just yet because that drama hasn't happened yet.
Right.
And so there's a lot of flipping and backflipping in order to appease canon or walk on the tightrope of canon. I mean, I know in Star Wars, you know, that George Lucas didn't think that Darth Vader was supposed to be anything more than the man who killed Luke Skywalker's father until he started writing Empire Strikes Back and was like, maybe he's his father.
Right.
You know, and it's not so hard to retcon something like that. It was an easy retcon because it's one element thing. There's a little bit of story, a little bit of narrative, but that's it. With Star Trek, we're looking at, you know, obviously the original series, there was no canon, you know? I mean, who knows what happened to, I mean, Lieutenant Leslie dies, what, 2 or 3 times?
Right.
You know, and or another gentleman, another security officer, not even named, appears as Lieutenant Leslie, even though Lieutenant Leslie was engineering before. So it's interesting to see just the lack of canon when the show started because no one cared. And then you see the Next Generation where they're being very careful to not step on the small bits of pieces of things that you mentioned in that long spanned era between the original series and Next Generation. I believe it's like 70 something years. Mm-hmm. And there's no issue really other than the writers feeling a need to recycle old stories at first. And what's funny is you don't actually get the best Trek writing of the Next Generation until they get to season 3. And in fact, season 3 is your most direct call out to the original series that at that point when you had the episode Sarek, where you literally have Spock's father reappear in the episode.
Right.
And he has the moment where he calls out to Spock. I mean, I don't know about you, but that kind of made me go, oh, shoot, this show's connected.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was the first big major connection that they had made to the original series. And of course it makes sense. You want to give these characters time to breathe and exist on their own. I think it would have been a mistake if they had brought in TOS characters any sooner.
Well, actually they did. They brought McCoy in the pilot, just to be clear.
Yeah. Excluding that was, you know, 90 seconds of screen time.
Yeah, exactly. But not for a whole episode. Not as the titular titular character.
Right, as we would later get a whole episode with Scotty and another two-parter, a legendary two-parter with Spock, and then a whole movie devoted around Kirk. So, you know, I feel like once they had established those characters, then they go into those threads. But you're right, the first 2 seasons really are just kind of attempting to, you know, strike the same bolt of lightning twice. And it wasn't until they started appreciating these characters individually and the brilliance that had been, you know, baked into their characters and their backstories, that they really began to fly. So on the one hand, the Next Generation could not have existed if it weren't for the pre-existing canon before it. But it wasn't until they took that canon and then began to write their own story with completely new characters that it began to take off. So it is kind of a catch-22, like, did canon help them or hurt them? I feel like for TNG, the answer is both.
Well, I think that Deep Space Nine actually is a great benefit to canon, actually. I mean, the fact that you have an established race in the Klingons and the Romulans and the Cardassians, in fact, to be able to then to introduce those characters on a reoccurring basis without having to explain them week to week. And now you're left with, you know, the Jem'Hadar, the Vorta, the Founders. You know, those are the new alien species that dominate. Besides, I guess, they also had the Bajorans already. Mm-hmm. But it's one of these things where the universe is, Deep Space Nine benefits from sort of a, this is the universe, this is what's in it. It's kind of built out. We're in our own little section of the galaxy, literally, jumping between two quadrants. But, and as vast as the scope of the show was for its time, I would say that Deep Space Nine really dove into whatever was out there in canon more than any of the other shows. And I don't think any show since. I mean, in fact, Deep Space Nine is the one that actually made the original series sort of modern canon in many ways, because, you know, even Gene Roddenberry was said to have mentioned that the Enterprise you see in the motion picture is how the Enterprise looks at the motion picture. But the Enterprise as it was in the original series isn't quite the Enterprise that one is. And he tried to blend the two by saying it's a refit, basically kind of trying to imply that the original series Enterprise didn't have the detail and design that would match, that would complement what was seen in the motion picture. And I digress, because the Deep Space Nine was really all about giving the audience a more fleshed out version of Klingons. I mean, we saw a Klingon wedding. We saw things about with Miles O'Brien working with the Orion Syndicate. These are all parts of the Star Trek universe that had all been hinted at some point. We saw Section 31. We'd never even seen Section 31 before.
Right.
I don't think there's a single... And going back to where it was responsible for original series canon, you have the episode Trials and Tribulations. We literally have Commander Sisko, Captain Sisko, meet Kirk. And there's no direct connection in Star Trek that's quite the same as that episode.
That's an interesting point. I don't think that any other episode of Star Trek prior to that had so directly gone back to the original series. And to your point, yeah, I think it never occurred to me that you really can't do Deep Space Nine without that pre-existing canon from both TOS or TNG, just because, you know, you didn't want to have to explain who are the Cardassians, who are the Bajorans. Yes, you do get an explanation as to the nature of their relationships, but you didn't need to introduce them afresh. You had the opportunity to stand on the shoulders of what had already been established, and then branch out into some very fascinating different things about character or about politics or about even economics on some episodes. So I think DS9 is a very good example of something that, you know, it does take, you know, the canon and branch out on its own, like anything successful does. But at the same time, it stands so firmly on top of canon, I don't think you can separate it.
No, I mean, you could even look at the first episode, Commander Sisko has that flashback to his time fighting at Wolf 359. We're literally introduced to a moment in canon of the Battle of Wolf 359 from Best of Both Worlds as the establishing point of where Deep Space Nine starts off. That's literally it. Now you compare that to other Trek series. You've got Voyager, and that show, while they launch from Deep Space Nine off onto their mission, it could have taken place anywhere. They just did it there just because there was nothing.
Right.
There was nothing there that really informed us about the character or their background or their story that was steeped in canon. Not the same way as Commander Sisko sitting down with Patrick Stewart, Captain Picard, and having this very tense exchange between the two of them, given the history that Sisko had with Picard when he was Locutus of Borg. And when you look at Enterprise, yeah, I mean, in some weird ways, Enterprise is pre-canon for a lot of things, but it's still post-canon, because if it weren't for the movie First Contact, it would have a lot more probably breathing room as to what it wants to do. But all of a sudden, First Contact established Zefram Cochran and the year he created the first warp ship, and this is where it happened, and blah, blah, blah. That already started sort of set at the ground for everything that we would see in that series. So that series was definitely, I think, a product of canon. If you look at Picard, obviously, you can't separate that show from canon. If you look at Lower Decks, you can't separate it from canon. If you look at Discovery, while it starts off for just a split moment away from canon, it tries so hard for the first season to shoehorn itself in there. And I think that brings us to the whole talk about, you know, there's lots of instances in Deep Space Nine and I think arguably in Lower Decks where canon works to the benefit of the show. Then there's things like with Discovery and Picard where they've had matters where they've struggled with canon.
Yeah, I think for Discovery, the canon issues that sort of plague me. And I'm one of those people who I'm not so offended by, you know, there being another secret child of Sarek or another sibling. This one was definitely played better than Cybok.
Cybok? Who's Cybok?
Oh, I'm sorry. He who shall not be named. My apologies. But I mean, he's literally no longer canon. He's unofficially no longer canon.
And that's an action. We should get onto that in a second, actually.
Well, let's go. We're here.
We're here. Okay, fine. You know what? I was just thinking, like, of all the things in Star Trek, and I know we've talked about this offline, of all the things in Star Trek, especially monumental things like this Trek films, the key moments in Trek history, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and please someone point out to me where this is incorrect. I cannot find a moment in Trek canon other than the photograph in Star Trek Beyond, which is a publicity photo for Star Trek V, of anywhere in any part of the Star Trek timeline did we get any sniff that Star Trek V ever occurred. No Captain Claw, no weird Enterprise, no romantic relationship between Uhura and Scotty.
Yeah,
no,
that came out of nowhere.
Deck 74 or 76 or whatever it was on a turbo shaft. Even the bridge of the ship, it's not the same as at any other point.
A big part of the story takes place on a planet where there's supposed to be diplomatic relations between Klingons, humans, and Romulans, in canonically a time where that would never fliggin' happen.
And then and even if you were to say, oh, well, this is that one exception or whatever, the fact is that then it tries to itself reach into canon and say, I want to go to a planet called Shakari, named after Sean Connery, and explore past the Great Barrier. And all of a sudden, the Great Barrier is in the center of the galaxy rather than the edge of the galaxy, which had been established in the original series. So now we're going to the center of the galaxy for this movie. Okay, noted. So we go to the Great Barrier. So now it's changed. It's gone center. Big difference. I kind of surprised that, you know, that somebody didn't just like quickly glance at the original series at the two times they went to the Great. Is it two times or three times? Three times.
At least twice.
So there was, they did it in once every season.
Right.
First season was obviously the first one where no man has gone before. Mm-hmm. Second season, you had it's the episode By Any Other Name that we just mentioned mm-hmm. earlier with Kalinda. And then the third season, you have the episode In Truth Is There No Beauty.
That's right.
And Spock is driven mad. Is it Spock driven mad? No. Who's driven mad and takes over the Enterprise and flies it into the barrier? And I don't even remember if they even called it the barrier. I just find it interesting that you can get to the barrier so quickly in Star Trek. It's like, oh, the galaxy is massive and huge, and we can explore 0.001% of it.
Right.
Oh, we're going to go to the edge of the galaxy, like in 3 hours.
Was it some ambassador? No, the ambassador Kolos is the one who drove people mad.
Yes, the ambassador drove people mad, but there was someone who took command of the ship out of a fit of rage and sent the Enterprise into the barrier like it was next door to it.
Marvik.
Oh, he was the other ambassador, right?
Right. I guess her assistant.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's right. The assistant. For some strange reason, the assistant has the skills and knowledge to be able to take over a starship and fly it into the barrier. Yes.
Right.
That's a classic season 3 move of the original series. But anyway, I digress to say that Star Trek V, as far as I'm concerned, it exists outside of canon. It's its own world. We never see Cybok again. We never see the center of the universe in Shakari again. I'm surprised nobody's bothered to go there again. Everything about that film exists in that film. I think the only thing that literally was seen first in that film and shown anywhere else were gravity boots.
Where else do the gravity boots come up?
Undiscovered Country.
Do they?
Oh yeah, that's how the assassins, they walk around on the Klingon ship.
That's right, you're right. I forgot, because this time the gravity boots are keeping you down rather than lifting you up.
So that's the only thing I can think of, and they're not even functioning the same. So as far as I'm concerned, it's like, well, you introduced it in Star Trek VI and no one's going to blink about it. No one's going to go, oh, where have that been before? No, Star Trek V. You could literally take Star Trek V out of canon and no one would notice a difference, other than they'd have to find a different photo for the cast for Star Trek Beyond. That's literally it. And it's a publicity photo.
Right.
It's literally a publicity photo.
Now, one other thing that's interesting that just struck me is that if you take of the movies, 2, 3, and 4, then they are a 3-act part. It's a 3-act story.
Mm-hmm.
You have Kirk, who is, you know, basically he starts off captain of the ship. No, he's not even the captain of the ship. He's an admiral.
Right.
Takes over the ship in a crisis, then later steals the ship due to a crisis, then gets another ship, saves the entire saves Earth due to a crisis. And it's sort of this, it's very much a Kirk story where he's going from one crisis to another, saving the galaxy at great personal cost, only to sort of wind up at his, as they often say, his first best destiny, being the captain of the Enterprise.
And it's interesting, it's funny to me that you've got all this back and forth of making Kirk a captain rather than an admiral. And I don't know, maybe it was just for fan service, it's like Captain Kirk just sounds more exciting than Admiral Kirk. Although I cannot imagine Captain Kirk rolling off of, you know, Ricardo Montalban's lips as savagely as he did in Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, I mean, just Montalban's delivery of Admiral Kirk would be enough to make me want to keep him as an admiral. That said, it's a little bit less exciting watching somebody sitting behind the desk signing orders than, you know, sitting on the bridge of a ship. But my point of that was just to point out how those three movies seem to sort of have, to a certain extent, their own specific canon, right? You can take those movies, and if you pick up, let's exclude part 5, pick up part 6 at the end, you can literally go between 1 and 6 to a certain extent, and you don't really lose a whole lot. I feel like Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, and The Voyage Home is this own self-contained, not saying it's not canonically connected to the rest of the series, but it is its own singular story to a certain extent. And I found that interesting insofar as that it also uses canon that is pre-established. You can't have these three movies without the pre-establishing canon. At the same time, with using canon, it tells its own specific story about the characters. And this is far more of a character journey than it is anything else.
Absolutely. I mean, the only thing that I think many people point out that feels like any sort of canon violation in those three films is the, how does Chekhov know who Khan is, or how does Khan know who Chekhov is?
Right.
That's the one big thing. And of course, Walter Koenig has famously explained that away. You've heard that one?
I have not.
Oh, so Walter Koenig has, on the convention circuit on many, many occasions, when asked this question, has his in-head explanation for how Khan remembers Chekhov is that at some point, you know, Chekhov was, you know, a lower, he's like a midshipman on the ship. He wasn't even an ensign, just some crew member serving on board. And at some point, you know, Khan needed to go use a restroom. And he was stuck waiting outside the restroom while Chekhov was using it on the ship. And when and then after waiting so while and being very impatient, the door opens and Chekhov comes out. And that irritated Khan because he'd been waiting so long. So that's why, and in fact, the first thing he says to Chekhov is, "I never forget a face."
Now I want that to be animated. I just want that to be a like a short trick that Mike McMahon does.
Yeah.
I just want that to be Khan has this bloodthirsty vengeance against, or you could just recontextualize it. Like, it was really all about Chekhov.
Yes. It was all about Chekhov and holding up Khan from using the head on the original Enterprise. And that's, and because of that, he'll never forget him.
I accept that. I can't go to the bathroom. I'm taking over this whole ship.
Exactly. But, you know, that's the thing. It's like, okay, we look at, you know, now they're doing Strange New Worlds. It's going to be coming out. And it's like, okay, that's another thing that's very steeped in canon. And it's interesting to me that Gene Roddenberry went out of his way to at least time-wise put Next Generation away from the Kirk era 73 years later. So it didn't feel like everything they did, every look of the show had to remain true to what you'd seen before. And then yet we have, you know, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Next Generation all taking place at the same time. Then you, they're trying to balance the canon of each. And the way they did it, of course, was, well, we'll have Next Generation being in the movie. So they're all one standalone stories, so to speak. You've got Deep Space Nine over in the Alpha Quadrant, Gamma Quadrant. And then you have Voyager in the Delta Quadrant. So, hey, no one will run into each other. We're all good.
Right.
So they managed to basically run themselves around canon from a standpoint of, like, one show doesn't have to affect what's going on in another. The one thing that we saw from week to week, though, was Bajoran and their feelings about a Cardassian are going to be consistent between it. Or, you know, Klingons have developed into sort of, you know, this warrior race, Bushido code type following species. And yes, the look of the Klingons has changed. It's changed many times.
Many, many.
And I think we all can pick our favorite Klingon look. Personally, I'm still a big fan of the look of Klingons from Search for Spock. I kind of feel like that's where it kind of set its bar. And I think it pretty much parallels the look of the Klingons that you see even in Deep Space Nine. Of course, you could always argue that the General Chang look in Undiscovered Country is its own thing.
Yeah, Chang is kind of an anomaly canonically in terms of the look of Klingons, just because, well, here's the interesting thing. You can say that he's a canonical anomaly, but you look at the Klingons from Discovery and they look almost exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they do as far as the facial type of features, but then of course, you know, in the Discovery, you have Klingons with like almost claw like hands,
right?
And these big like razor teeth that seem to affect the speech of the actors portraying the roles. I kind of wish they'd scale that back just for the actors being a little bit more intelligible. You know, and then of course, just the dress of the Klingons, they went very sort of like Persian, you know, Western Asian type influences, North African influences in sort of the Klingon decor, as opposed to, you know, I think much more like East Asian that you saw through the era with Worf, just even the design of the Bat'leth and sort of the sweeping nature of it.
As I've talked about the Klingons from the TNG era versus the Discovery era, because I know I've made the comment that the Discovery era Klingons, their style of clothing looks very sub-equatorial. And I initially remembered the Klingons in the original series, not the original series, in TNG and Deep Space Nine era as being, it felt sort of Russian-Soviet. And then as I look over it and started watching more of the Klingon episodes, I realized this is more to do with story than it does real world parallels. Because as they had established it, Kronos, the Klingon home planet, is this volcanic world. Like, it's not just all lava, but there's so many volcanoes that send ash up into the air, it blocks out the sun, and it's actually particularly cold. So it's cold and ashy. So of course they would wear things like leather and furs and things like that. So it wasn't you know, really this, you know, a real world parallel or an attempt to be an allegory. It was totally based upon the story of the characters, the culture, the planet, where they come from, as opposed to Discovery. It felt like none of that, those story considerations mattered. It was all purely about design, as opposed to would they wear this on their home world?
Yeah, I mean, it does. It does definitely reek of that. But the, I think the question I have, and I wonder so much with the writers of Discovery, is did they feel like they were painted so much into a corner they had to jump the show 1,000 years in the future? Was that the reason for the jump? Did they realize that, you know, it sounded cool maybe with the CBS executives to say, hey, we're going to set the show 10 years before Kirk and Spock. Oh, cool. Yeah, so we get to like kind of revisit this old era, yet not. And I don't understand what that's meant to service, because it's kind of like, okay, if you go back to like the 1960s, you had Godzilla versus King Kong, or King Kong versus Godzilla, depending on if you were in Japan or the US.
Right.
And of course, the ending of the film depended on if you were in the US or Japan. And the reality is, you're never going to have a movie of this versus that that's going to be satisfying to two different fan bases. Alien versus right. Predator, Batman versus Superman. It's just not, it's just, in the end, you're just not going to walk away satisfied with any of these versus type things. Now, not, we're not dealing with a versus type thing in this case, but you are dealing with a series in Discovery that's kind of running itself parallel to the original series and trying in some ways, I think, it, to be sort of a new reset point for Star Trek as a whole by mm-hmm. doing so. But my question is, why do that? Why set it at that era? Because I'm not sure what fan base or potential fan base you're serving. If you're a non-fan, you could set it at any time. They're not going to care. Not going to know. As long as the story, you know, works and is interesting. As a fan, you've got two ways to look at it. Oh, I don't care. I'm going to completely ignore it. I've never really cared too much about consistency in my shows. I'll just watch it and be entertained by it. It's purely entertainment. Now, if you're a fan who like follows all the shows and watched all the movies and possibly even read novels or comics and everything else under the sun about Star Trek, it's like that period of Trek history has a lot of information in it over the years. Right. 700 episodes preceded Discovery. And in 700 episodes and 13 movies, you know, chances are you're going to run into something. And sure enough, they did. And they ran into it again and again. And then they basically rewrote, in many ways, rewrote canon. Discovery ran into canon again and again in all kinds of ways that really it didn't need to. I mean, you and I have talked about this as well. I'm a strong believer that Discovery could have easily been set in the post-Undiscovered Country era, which Brian Fuller had actually alluded to was an inspiration in making Discovery. So I wonder, at what point did someone decide we want to set it in almost a hot zone of Trek history and try to maneuver through it and touch on various things just off the beaten path of the original series, but no, our show is canon, despite the fact that there's an episode of the original series that takes place 10 years later where Captain Kirk turns to Uhura. It's the episode Squire of Gothos, and asks if her signal she's receiving is from the USS Discovery. So it's like at every turn, Discovery was running into stuff, including the name of its own ship. So unless there's another Discovery that was built afterwards to cover it up, which I guess you could always make up something like that the same way you would that Chekhov was inside the restroom holding up Khan from using it. You know, you could always make up things to explain away canon in different ways. I mean, there's plenty of ways to do it. They retconned the Klingon look. And then, of course, now Discovery basically poured cold water on that retcon. So it's like what the Klingons, all right. So the Klingons look like this, and then they look like this, then they look like this, then they look like this. They actually managed to explain it by the Enterprise of the Klingon look change. And then Discovery was just like, nope, your Klingon look is bashed. No more.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, did Discovery, did anybody look at that, or did they know that that was a part of canon, or did they just say, we're going to do our own thing?
That's the thing I keep wondering. I mean, there's just, there's like so many times that, and I don't know, and I know that these shows are not written as a single individual anymore the way they would even back in the 90s, where you would, you know, assign a writer to a show and a writer would go off and write a script and come back and share it with the, you know, the executive producer, now known as a showrunner. That's how shows were mainly written back then. It wasn't actually until the 90s that you started having writers' rooms. That actually was not something that you generally saw in television until that point. TV was written by one guy, usually, behind a computer or typewriter at their desk, you know, slaving away at their notes that they were given from an outline that either they generated or the writing staff generated as a whole. But you wrote your script all by yourself.
Right.
And so now it's like you have 6-7 people sitting in a room developing and sculpting out the arcs of these shows. And somehow, you know, I'm not sure what the powers that be or what make these decisions that seem to paint the writers into corners that they don't need to have put themselves into. That's constantly how I keep feeling about these things with Discovery in particular, is they painted themselves. And then it's like, oh, so we're going to jump 800, 900 years in the future so we can save ourselves from canon. You know, so now we're free of the timeline restrictions of canon, but now, you know, my question, and I am assuming season 4 of Discovery is going to answer, I think, a big question that I have, is Discovery set so far into the future that the technology becomes magic and not, it's beyond our leap of understanding or belief that it could evolve to?
Right, because if so, then you lose what has been a big part of Star Trek for a very long time, and that is plausible science.
Right?
How many different things that the original series introduced that we all take for granted now? The heart monitor. That wasn't commonly used in hospitals before Dr. McCoy had a heart monitor on the set or on the original series. The communicators, we carry one every day now. It's called a cell phone.
Right. I mean, in fact, they had to even retcon the cell phone in the Star Trek Into Darkness by giving it the ability to receive text messages.
Right. And then you have pads. The Next Generation literally introduced touch screens before they were a thing.
Very primitive, but yeah.
Very primitive, but still touch screens. When you go into Captain Picard's ready room, what did you see? You saw a little computer there. There was no keyboard. You have no idea how the hell he uses it, but it's a computer on his desk. And it did not look anything like the computers that you had around 1987 to 1994, 95. So I felt like if you, and again, I realized that Discovery kind of needed to flee from the corner that they had painted themselves in canonically. At the same time, I don't want to lose the value of, you know, the speculative science that you get from Star Trek often. And I think that there may be a possibility that they can have their cake and eat it too. It won't necessarily be something, you know, it may still be things that are relatively plausible, just not possible now, which I can kind of accept that. Because on the other hand, if you go around the era of, let's say that Discovery had been set around the time where Picard is set now. So roughly, you know, 10 years after the last time we saw the Next Generation crew, the universe up to that point, even then you still have canonical issues. They haven't quite painted themselves into a corner, but you're going to start asking, where are the Borg? Where's Data? Where since, you know, all these sorts of questions that Picard thankfully has been able to avoid by focusing their stories strictly on the character and the emotions and the journey that he's going through emotionally. So I do wonder if there was any way for Discovery to, you know, fit safely in canon without there being problems. But the going 1,000 years in the future seems like a big reaction as opposed to, you know, this is our logical step of how we solve this. It's like, screw it, throw the baby out and the bathwater.
Yeah, I feel like it was somebody's initial challenge to make it in that Kirk Spock era. And they just were like, okay, it's just too much. We got to get out of here.
It was at one point during sometime Discovery season one, season two, I literally thought that they've painted themselves so deeply into a corner. They're getting ready to reboot the original series and just recast and restart it all. Because I'm like, I don't know how you continue to do this show in that time period and not just constantly butt up against these canon issues.
I mean, I don't know where that line existed. I mean, I'm sure that by the time Discovery ends its run on streaming or television or however it ends, first run, you know, actors and writers and producers will eventually begin to talk. And I think the one thing that I'm most interested to hear is about the genesis of Discovery, that process, because you had Brian Fuller, obviously a Trek writer from prior times on Deep Space Nine, very aware of canon, as we've established. And then we also had Nick Meyer, who was the writer-director of Star Trek 2, 4, and well, writer of 4, and then director of 6. Very well aware of the Kirk-Spock era of things, so to speak. Now, Nick has always been very adamant that, you know, he didn't respect canon, and he's just going to make the look this way and that way. But I would think that between the two of them, there has to be like a consideration of, you know, where do we want to set the show? You know, the sky's the limit. And somewhere in there, someone made the decision that the show should be set in the era that it was started at, as opposed to, as we've said, why not set it in the Enterprise B era? Why not set it post Undiscovered Country so that you have a fallen Klingon empire that you can unify? Why pick the time that you do and butt up against canon and the criticisms that faces? Because obviously the new fans aren't going to care if you did it then or later or whatever. But canon is this thing now. It's become, I think it's this wonderful thing that when used properly allows you to quickly world build rather complicated situations, just because fan bases have a built-in knowledge of like, well, why are they doing this? Or who's that? What's the politics of that? You don't have to explain that all. Now, when it comes to, you know, now you're going back into that era, into the lion's den of it, and you're going to say now all of a sudden the Klingons are going to start a war with the Federation. I mean, one of the lines in Star Trek II, Carol Marcus says Starfleet's kept the peace for over 100 years.
Right.
Yet there's a war that would have happened presumably 10 years earlier.
Not just any war, a war that took out most of Starfleet leadership.
Oh, yeah. So it seems kind of odd to me that would escape her memory.
That war where we almost lost our entire civilization. I forgot about that one, man.
I forgot how Starfleet kept the peace in that, and how they were, you know, Michael Burnham as a member of Starfleet was responsible for breaking that peace. So it's really a question of why do you set it clearly in an era where you literally wrote the line. You know, Nick, you wrote that line, or at least you rewrote it from somebody else. Who knows? But my point is, you could set that show in post-Undiscovered Country era. You could still have all the same politics you had with the Klingons. You could still set the Spock and Michael dynamic up. And in fact, it would be kind of interesting to me that you could have more believably, as far as my concern, that Michael Burnham would never have come up with Spock because she would be at that point much younger than Spock. So they probably didn't grow up together. So I think you could have, I think that's the dynamic between the two of them that would have changed. And I think that would have been an interesting thing to actually explore. But I think that, you know, there'd have been a lot more freedom for the writer afforded to the writers to actually be able to tell the stories they wanted to without butting into canon.
Right. I mean, another thing too, I just thought about as we talk about canon, you know, they went 1,000 years in the future, or several hundred years, but before they did that, I began wondering in season two, why is it that no one in all of Star Trek said, remember that ship that ran on mushrooms? Can we make more?
Well, yeah. And then, I mean, there's also just the bizarre thing of, you know, they've been stricken from the history of all of Starfleet. And, you know, honestly, I can buy that up to a certain point.
Right.
But I would say if the mushroom ship here's the thing. I think they grasped at straws, in effect, in saying that the ship ran on mushrooms. I think, in fact, they could have made it some flavor of transwarp.
Right.
And that it was a failed transwarp experiment, like a variation of transwarp.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people would have believed that as something that wouldn't have been explored much outside of that in canon. And that, of course, would have been, you know, post Search for Spock era. But it would have at least helped us wrap our minds around the idea of why would a ship that was part of a different program, a secret program, from hundreds of years prior to the Next Generation era, 100 years at least, that discovery wasn't, that technology wasn't rediscovered.
Right.
You know, I granted, nobody rediscovered making Genesis. Maybe, you know, I mean, there's always the question of like, how big a leap is that? You know, I mean, I always wondered, you know, just to talk in terms of science, how exactly Genesis works, because if it was creating life from lifelessness and you exploded it in a nebula, did it just, I guess it just sucked all the gas from the nebula and made it into the planet, which I would imagine there's enough matter there that you would have not just a massive planet with huge gravitation, gravity, or you'd have an entire star system.
Right.
Made out of the Genesis device. Where did all the excess nebula go to? Did it just spur it away? I don't know. It doesn't really matter, but something I think about sometimes. And then suddenly the Genesis planet has a star shining on it now. So is that star part of the Genesis?
Now, here's an interesting thing, just to take us really quickly back to Discovery. What we were mentioning about the spore drive. So and all the canonical story reasons why it could or could not or should or shouldn't exist, the writer in me says this was just someone who wanted to get your characters from point A to point B as quickly as possible without having to deal with, oh, we'll be there in 18 hours. Oh, we'll be there. You just go there instantly and then pick up the story. Now, it felt like a device.
You know, it's funny you just said that, because I was thinking to myself, that's actually something that in many ways J.J. Abrams adopted in his films to begin with, without creating a new device. He literally just made it seem like, oh, we're going to warp to Kronos. It will take us 5 minutes. We're going to warp back to Earth. It's 30 seconds away. And suddenly everything became Star Wars speed.
Yeah.
And rather than this galaxy is really, 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 really big. The Next Generation, how many times if you listen to them talk timeline, Picard will say to Data, how far until we go there if we're at warp 6? And he'll say 18 hours, 12 minutes. And he goes, okay, what about warp 8? It'll be 7 hours, 6 minutes. Great, let's go to warp 8.
Right.
It's like, but it's still 7 hours away. Whereas Discovery, instantly. J.J. Kelvin movies. Oh, we're going to warp halfway across the quadrant instantly.
Yeah, we'll be there in 20 minutes.
Yeah, so even warp technology, and I mean, just talk about that in canon, is you know, it's a plot device. And you know, Star Trek over the years has used that time journeying from one location to another to actually, as it became later known, pillar filler.
Yeah.
To have that time where these characters can interact and think about what's coming next and sort of talk about that, what's to come or what did happen or what will happen while they're on their way. And now it's just like, okay, all this action's happening and we're here. Okay. All right. Now we have to go there. Cool. We're there. There's like no, and is this a, is it a function of the audience and the tastes of our audience today that they can't, that we cannot as an audience stomach hearing somebody say it's going to take 20 hours to get somewhere?
I don't think so. I think it's literally just,
is that cultural?
I mean, we do now have an audience that is, you know, accustomed to a faster pace. I wouldn't even call them less patient. That wouldn't be fair. I would say they're accustomed to a faster pace. That said, you do have an audience that is intelligent enough to realize that while this is happening, these characters are doing other things. So I feel like it's more a matter of modern pacing. And it's sort of a question of, is there even room for pillar filler nowadays when you have to get on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, just to make sure your audience doesn't flip away?
Well, I would think that, I mean, it's not even flip away. I mean, the danger in the 90s was you would get that remote and change the channel. I think the danger today is you pick up your cell phone and start reading your text messages.
Right.
It's a different beast, you know, because you could take that remote and flip the channel, but the other channel's got a commercial break.
Right.
You'll eventually find a website that doesn't throw an ad on you at the first sight of anything.
That's true. Yet at the same time, it's still the same effect. If you're looking at your phone and what's happening on screen isn't drawing your attention, then why would you watch the next episode?
But I mean, I guess the real thing is, what's going to happen next with Discovery? Is that going to be, is the show going to improve as a result of it freeing itself from the chains of canon, if you will? Or is it going to burden itself in ways that it didn't foresee? I mean, it seems that the only show that seems to run at canon and embrace canon the same way that I haven't seen since Deep Space Nine is Lower Decks.
Right.
I mean, the show was like, it was in the 2260s and that's how Kirk talked, you know, right. Or just, you know, the whole, you know, Riker on the Titan, and everything just seems to fit what we know in Trek lore to the T. I mean, they even go back to the planet from the Return of the Archons planet. I forgot the name of it, the planet, but mm-hmm. You know, they go back and revisit that. In fact, and we have the Packlets even.
Yeah.
So completely. And canonically it makes sense.
Right.
So whereas Discovery literally jumped 1,000 years in the future to avoid canon, Lower Decks is like, come over here, you canon. Give you a big hug.
Yeah, Lower Decks really does treat canon like it is a big fluffy dog.
Yeah, it runs at canon in a way that I haven't seen. I don't think any other Trek show currently does.
I think my final thing about Discovery and canon is that I hope that it begins to get a little bit more DS9 insofar as that you can stand on the shoulders of canon. You don't have to be slavishly devoted to it. And you can establish, you know, your own canon. You can branch out and grow from there. You can even continue to have your little Easter eggs if you want. I don't know if I would have chosen the Guardian of Forever, but that could be a fun Easter egg. So I feel like I hope that Discovery kind of goes more in that direction. And if any, I know that writer's room and the styles are completely different now, but I wish they just invite Ira Stephen Bear in for just one episode. Just one.
Amen. I think that that's about all the time we have for today. There's, of course, you could talk about canon for
hours,
days, weeks. But I think that's something that, you know, any of our listeners are free to explore. And again, please message us. I'd love to hear if you have any connections between Star Trek V and the rest of the Star Trek universe, aside from the gravity boots and a photograph.
I think I may have just thought of one. So in the original series, Uhura was, and we know that Nichelle Nichols was a Broadway musical theater dancer and singer. So we do know that Uhura in the original series would sort of sing and dance. Well, in Star Trek V, you have the fan dance.
Okay. Did the fan dance come up again somewhere?
No, it hasn't come up since Star Trek V, but at least it was, you have a little bit of a connection to the original series.
Well, yeah, there's the connection. I mean, right. But I'm just trying to think, is there anything that took things that were established in Star Trek V and used it?
Oh, no, not at all. Nor should they have. Story Trek is still brought to you by no one.
Hey, but we have now apparently made eclipsed the hill of being legitimate podcast?
Yes, we are now legitimate. Hey.
Yes. And the fact that we've recorded this 7th episode of our show makes us legitimate. So everybody out there, you're listening to a legitimate show, just so you know. Even though we're not sponsored by anybody.
We're real people and real Star Trek fans.
Exactly. And as real people, we have a lot of things that we do in our lives. Unfortunately, that's one of the reasons we don't get to record these shows as often as we'd like, but, you know, enjoy doing them. And I hope everyone out there enjoys listening to us. And we'd love to hear feedback from all of you, however you think about things, you know, whether or not we're just rambling on here or you have something you want to add to our conversation. We'd love to hear from you.
You can always contact us on Twitter at @story_trek.
And of course, we have a Facebook page
at @StoryTrekMM. The M is for Mike and the M is for Marshall.
Exactly. And just to top it off, you can always subscribe on your favorite podcast app to this podcast so that you can hear our future episodes when they drop and not rely necessarily on just our Twitter announcements, which may get lost in your feeds. So please do hit that like and subscribe. Give us a review. It always helps to kind of raise those metrics, I'm sure. And until then, next time you listen to us, this is Michael Stratigakis.
This is Marshall Hopkins.
Live long and prosper.